Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And here's a stat to start your day that might explain a lot of where the world is right now, personally and politically. The hunger relief and anti-poverty group Oxfam, in its annual survey, finds 82% of the wealth generated last year went to the richest 1% of the global population. 82% of the wealth went to the richest 1%, while the 3.7 billion people who make up the poorest half of the world saw no increase in their wealth. The report is being launched as political and business elites gather for the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. We will see if that generates any meaningful conversation in Davos. Winnie Byanyima, executive director of Oxfam, said the billionaire boom is not a sign of a thriving economy, but a symptom of a failing economic system. The people who make our clothes, assemble our phones, and grow our food are being exploited to ensure a steady supply of cheap goods and swell the profits of corporations and billionaire investors, unquote, from the executive director of Oxfam International. But do those realities Oxfam points to lead to the rise in ethnic nationalism and authoritarianism that we talk about here constantly, or push against them? We'll get to that today with several guests. Our first guest is the very prolific New York Times columnist, David Leonhardt, former Washington bureau chief, former economics columnist, and original leader of their data site, The Upshot. So besides his column in the print edition, David blogs regularly online, and he always seems on what's important, on new developments and big picture values. Just in recent days, he's written on what makes Kamala Harris an instant front runner in the presidential race, but also why he wants Joe Biden to run, why the government shutdown, which began its second month this morning, is a sign of the weakness of the resistance, and why he's in favor of removing Trump from office now, not waiting for the Mueller report. Enough to talk about with David Leonhardt. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for that nice introduction.
Want to start with Kamala Harris? I'll play a clip of her from yesterday that you highlighted in your piece, and you'll tell us why. Here it is.
Nobody is living their life through the lens of one issue. And I think what people want is they want leadership that sees them through the complexity of each of our lives and pays equal attention to their needs. Let's not put people in a box.
Senator Kamala Harris talking at Howard University. David Leonhardt with us, who also, by the way, is co-host of the Times, The Argument podcast. So, David, why did you draw attention to that?
So, I think a lot of presidential candidates, when they're starting, have a sharp theme. In the case of Barack Obama, obviously it was this idea of hope and change. I think some of the other candidates this year, like Elizabeth Warren, and if he runs, Bernie Sanders, will talk a lot about some of the inequality and economic justice issues that you talked about at the very top of the show. And Kamala Harris doesn't have such a theme, at least yet. She instead is a very impressive young Democrat who has a fascinating personal story. She would be the first Asian American president. She's part Indian American. But she doesn't really have a theme, in part because she has spent most of her recent public career as the Attorney General of California and as a prosecutor. And so basically that means that what she's done, put people in jail, is not completely in line with where the Democratic Party is right now. And so she's not running on her recent bio. She doesn't have policy positions that are different from other Democrats. She's just running essentially as a relatively standard Democrat, and I don't mean this as a criticism, who is extremely talented, extremely impressive, and has a fascinating life story. And so when you hear her saying, I don't want to put people in a box, I don't want to talk about individual issues, that's both true, but it's also a little bit of a defense mechanism on her part, because she doesn't really have a niche, and I think that has both upsides and downsides for her candidacy.
On her policy positions, which you just said are typical for a Democrat, you wrote also in your piece, the policy agenda of Senator Harris looks fairly typical for a Democrat today. It made me think, most of them are going to be running on pretty much the same set of policy items. I wonder if you see at this early point policy disagreements breaking out among the leaders in the Democratic presidential field, as let's face it, real policy differences did break out between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yes, and they broke out between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008, although Obama and Clinton were closer than Sanders and Clinton. I mean, the one that many people may remember is this fight over whether there should be a mandate. And then, of course, this great ironic thing in which Obama won and then flipped his position to Hillary's. I think he honestly held the position he did at the time. I expect we will see disagreements. Let's set Bernie aside for just a minute. We can come back to him. I suspect we will see disagreements among people like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, and if he runs, Joe Biden and Sherrod Brown. But I think there'll be more of the Hillary Obama variety. I think they will be relatively narrow disagreements. I don't think they will be defining disagreements. The Democratic Party has moved to the left on economic policy over the past decade, which I think is an appropriate move in response to reality. My own views on economics have moved somewhat to the left over the last decade. And so I think that we'll see some disagreements, but I don't think the most important thing for voters to be thinking about at this point are the precise policy prescriptions. I would instead think about which candidates seem to have the ability to make a case and which ones seem to have the personal, not just gravitas, but the ability to deal with the ups and downs of the presidency. I think probably that matters more than exactly how they want to help the middle class through the tax code.
Maybe another new wrinkle, given how the field is shaping up, is that an email, I guess a fundraising email, went out to her potential base from Kamala Harris's husband in the last day, saying basically, I woke up today and got ready to support my wife, the candidate. I'm not sure we even saw that from Bill Clinton. But at the same time that you're interested in Kamala Harris, you wrote a piece the other day titled, Why Biden Should Run. A big mistake of 2016 was trying to decide in advance who the best candidate was. Well, obviously, it's a wide open field this year. But why Biden? Some people say Biden shouldn't run.
I think the people who argue Biden run often are arguing that they don't want to vote for Biden. And they're confusing the should he run with do they like him. And I actually would ask people to take a step back and separate those two questions. My full-throated plea for him to run was not an endorsement of him. Here's my case. In 2016, we, well in advance of the primaries, we saw all these people take themselves out because they didn't think they could win. The key ones to me were Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. And so Hillary ran with really Bernie Sanders as her only competition. Bernie Sanders ran a really impressive outsider campaign, but he maxed out. I mean, his total vote among Democratic primary voters was in the low 40%. I think it was about 43%. And, you know, Bernie's a self-identified Democratic socialist from Vermont. He ran a great campaign, but I don't think he ever would have won. And I think as the summer of 2016 came around, it became clear that Hillary Clinton had a lot of weaknesses as a candidate. But it was too late. Democrats really hadn't run a full campaign. And the reason that I want Biden to run is I think there's nothing more important than making sure Donald Trump does not continue to serve beyond his term. And as you mentioned, I actually don't think he deserves to finish his term.
And we will get to that.
We'll get to that. But Joe Biden is unlike any other candidate. And this notion that we know what the mood of the electorate is going to be like in 3, 6, 9, 12, even 14 months when the primaries will still be going on, we don't know. For that matter, Mike Pence could be president 14 months from now. And when you think about his experience, when you think about his connection to the Obama presidency, Joe Biden is unlike any of these other candidates, most of whom are younger, who are fresher faces. And so I'm not saying people should vote for Biden. I'm not predicting Biden's going to win. I'm saying the Democrats shouldn't try to start eliminating candidates at this stage. And if Joe Biden wants to run, he should run. I don't think he's likely to win, because at this point, I don't think any individual candidate is likely to win. But the idea of eliminating him, who looks unlike any other candidate in this race, strikes me as a strategic unforced error on the part of Democrats at this point.
Listeners, our phones are open on some of the issues. David Leonhardt is opening up today, Kamala Harris as a front runner, as he calls her, and why Joe Biden should run, as you just heard him arguing, and more general themes on some of the other Democrats. Also, which we'll get to now, his piece saying the shutdown shows the weakness of the resistance, and the question of should Donald Trump already be removed from office? Should the Democrats start that process without waiting for the Mueller report? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for New York Times columnist David Leonhardt this morning. Okay, you wrote that piece headlined, "The Shutdown Shows the Weakness of the Resistance." Premise, you're a big fan of the resistance. So how does the shutdown show its weakness?
And you know, in the old days, we journalists could say, well, I don't write my own headlines. But that's mostly not true anymore. For the online versions, we write our own headlines. They need the approval of editors. And I wrote that headline, and I felt really uncomfortable about writing it because, as you say, I'm a real fan of the resistance. I mean, I think it's accomplished enormous good. The two biggest examples are, I think Obamacare repeal succeeds without the resistance, and I think millions of Americans today who have health insurance would not have it. And then I think the resistance was absolutely central to the defeat of the Republican House majority, a Republican House majority that refused to hold Donald Trump accountable for breaking his constitutional oath. So I think that's all great. But let's think about the shutdown for a minute. Trump is an unpopular president. Most voters correctly blame him for the shutdown. He and the Republicans supporting in Congress are the weak parties here. And yet we see absolutely no popular movement, no big protests, no sick outs by federal workers, no strikes by federal workers meant to increase the pressure on Trump to end this, meant to have Americans see just how bad it is to have the government not fully functioning and 800,000 people forced in many cases to go to work and not be paid. And as I've talked to people from other countries in the last few weeks, they've said to me, this is amazing. In other countries, you would see enormous protests. And I consider it a reminder that as much good as the grassroots progressive movement has done, it is not nearly strong enough in this country for the scale of challenges we face: climate change, inequality, our fraying democracy. And so while I want to cheer the resistance, I also think it's important to offer some friendly criticism and say, hey, if we actually had a strong grassroots progressive movement in this country, the shutdown wouldn't look like the way the shutdown has looked.
What do you think about the Trump compromise, he calls it? Is it the basis for negotiations and an end to the shutdown?
I think I'm a little torn because I do think basically you should always negotiate. And I do think there's a point at which you could imagine, I mean, I can at least hypothetically imagine a deal so good that Democrats would be insane to reject it. I mean, imagine a deal where they get full legal status, path to citizenship for all the Dreamers, right? You'd really have to think about that in exchange for a few billion for a wall. But I'm against this deal. It's not nearly that. It's not the Democrats wouldn't get much in this deal. The Dreamers wouldn't get much. It's a temporary extension of the status they already have. No path to citizenship. And I think it's a sign of Trump's weakness here. I mean, look, I think if Democrats can remain united here, I think ultimately Trump is the one who's likely to have to fold. But, you know, to repeat, boy, would it help if there were any kind of popular grassroots support on the side of ending the shutdown.
Interesting reactions coming in to your plea to Joe Biden to run. One listener writes on Twitter, "Joe Biden, don't run. Please, your time is in 2016. Now it's time to move on, and we need a woman at this juncture." Another guy says, and these are both guys, says the guy on saying says the more candidates that enter, the closer we are to a fair electoral process due to broader representation. Then there's this caller, Roseanne on Staten Island. Roseanne, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling up.
Hi, Brian. I'm a first-time caller, so I'm very excited.
Glad you're in.
I have to start that I'm a liberal. I voted for Hillary. I will vote for who, honestly, most likely whoever the Democratic candidate is. Having said that, I just based on what happened in 2016, based on what, you know, we saw, I don't think America's actually ready for a woman. I don't think that they are ready for diversity. Even though we had, you know, Barack Obama, I just feel like our best bet is Joe Biden. And I get a lot of, you know, criticism from my fellow liberal friends, especially the women. How could you say that? And I'm like, I just don't want Trump in office. And I think he is our best bet. I firmly believe that. It's just, you know, but again, I'm very excited for, you know, the candidates that are coming about. I want to see what happens. But this is my opinion.
What about for you, Roseanne, the fact that there was such a surge of women voters, including new women voters, in the 2018 midterms, and that as a possible signal of where the source of strength and turnout would come against a presumed Donald Trump reelection campaign?
I love it. I'm very excited. I mean, I'm not joking. I cried for weeks after Hillary lost. So this is something I do feel strongly about. I feel I'm ready for a woman. I don't feel like the mass of America is. Yeah. And I feel like the Electoral College made that very evident in those states.
Mm-hmm. Roseanne, I'm going to leave it there. Please call us again. David Leonhardt, I got a similar call yesterday from a woman in Brooklyn identifying herself as an African-American woman and saying she doesn't think America enough, you know, Americans in the Electoral College system will vote for a woman or a person of color today. I'm frankly kind of shocked that these calls are coming in the numbers that they are, because we have plenty on both sides of this question. And I'm surprised that it's even that much of a debate right now among Democrats.
Yep. Look, it's a real fear that people have, and I think it's a deep fear that women have. I mean, I have some of the things that Roseanne just said, I have heard extremely similar arguments from my wife, who shares this fear about whether America is ready to vote for a woman. And you can dig into the social science research, and it's clear, particularly for executive offices, which the president has obviously won, rather than legislative offices, there is a decent, substantial amount of mostly latent, but sometimes blatant sexism out there. The two things I would say are, I am really glad that we are going to have a Democratic primary with multiple women running. Because I think what often happens when you have one woman in a race is we the society, the media, end up trafficking in a lot of sexist stereotypes. Is she likable? You know, is she shrill? Is she, you know, can she handle the pressure? With multiple women running, I think it will be harder for those stereotypes not to be exposed as sexist stereotypes, because I think if people start wondering, well, is Elizabeth Warren likable, and is Kamala Harris likable, and is Amy Klobuchar likable, and is Kirsten Gillibrand likable, I think it'll be pretty clear at that point that it's sexism. So my hope is that having multiple women will in some ways highlight some of this bias out there. And I guess in the end, I would say, while I agree that there is a risk that a female candidate will be damaged by sexism, we don't know. I think most Americans would have said they felt the same thing in 2008 about Obama. And in the end, I would encourage people to make a decision based on who they think the best candidate is. So Roseanne should vote for Joe Biden. The person who wrote in should vote against Joe Biden. But I guess I'm going to choose optimism. And I think the mere notion of having a female nominee, if that's what happens, will play some role in curing some of that sexism, because it'll then be the second time in a row, and it won't be one of the Clintons who come with a lot of baggage.
Just on
and
this.
I realize that's it on the one hand,
yeah.
Other hand answer.
And on this question of likability as something that either political analysts or individual voters should try to measure or are taking stock of, how likable is Donald Trump? And whoever asked that question, half his supporters don't like him.
Exactly. I do think the lesson of Donald Trump is, and David Axelrod, Obama's former advisor, talks about this all the time, authenticity. So Donald Trump is many things, right? I have written many, many negative things about Donald Trump. Like you, I'm from New York. I watched his rise. I cannot believe he is president. But he kind of doesn't fake a lot of stuff. He lies, but he doesn't fake who he is. And
that's an interesting distinction, by the way, for somebody who has a reputation as such a con man.
Yep. But he almost revels in his being a con man, right? Like, he revels in lying. Mm-hmm. When other presidents have been caught in untruths, they've stopped saying them. He doesn't. And so I guess, setting aside Donald Trump, I think it's really important for candidates to give voters a sense that their voters are seeing some version of the real person.
There you go. Amos in Maplewood. You're on WNYC with New York Times columnist David Leon Hart. Hi, Amos.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, Brian. I just wanted to point out I do like Kamala Harris. I like Biden. I even like Beto. The thing is, I am not the supporter, and the reason is that we're facing one major issue: the climate change, the global climate change, and that is something we have 10 years to deal with. It will require dramatic changes. And anybody who is receiving funds from corporations that are related to that issue, or any issue in fact, are not progressive. They're not going to be able to effectively turn on these industries and make the painful changes that are required.
I'm glad you raised this issue, Amos, and I'm going to move on for time, but we're going to deal with your issue. David, if you haven't written about this one yet, you should, and dig into it with all your background and being a Washington bureau chief and statistical analysis and everything else, because this one is breaking out. You know, whether presidential or any other Democratic candidates are going to take corporate money. We've been having a thread of conversation on this show about New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone, who just got elevated with Democratic control of the House to head of the Energy and Commerce Committee. And he would not renounce on this show fossil fuel industry donations. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and that wing of the party is obviously digging in very strongly on the other side of that, and people might like Pallone, who are otherwise progressive, might get primaried in 2020, and different presidential candidates. And I don't know what Kamala Harris has done with respect to corporate PACs or certain industries, including fossil fuels, as being off limits for campaign donations. But I think this is going to be huge.
Assignment accepted. I will look more into that. The one other thing I'd add to that is I do think it's important. So I think this pressure on corporate donations from the fossil fuels industry is really important. So this is a yes and, not a mm-hmm. disagreement. I also think it's really important for progressives to think about how to persuade ordinary voters of this, because a lot of the complications of the politics of climate change come from the kind of stuff we've seen in France, where you're often essentially arguing for middle class and working class and lower income people who've had a tough couple decades to pay higher taxes. And I think that is as important as the corporate angle, which is how do you make people feel like climate change is not something that's just going to make their short-term lives worse? Addressing climate change is not going to make their lives worse, and it's really hard.
Marvin in Brooklyn on the government shutdown. Marvin, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Brian. By the way, there's a wonderful column by Michelle Goldberg in today's Times about women running, and also a letter by me about why Joe Biden shouldn't run. But I was calling because what's not been talked about in terms of the government shutdown is the horrendous image of all of these people with good, solid, decent-paying jobs who can't make it without if they miss one paycheck, that this really shows the fragility of the American economy and the situation of American working people, that all these government workers who are having to make terrible economic choices because they miss literally one paycheck. Can you talk more about that, David, and what that says about the state of our economy and economic inequality?
Happily. Should I jump in, Brian?
Please.
I mean, I think it is. There was a chart in the Times that people can look up that had a headline, something like the chart that shows how much federal workers are suffering. I didn't work on it, but I learned a lot from it, and it showed exactly what Marvin's talking about, which is how many federal workers just don't have much in savings and much of a cushion. And I think it's an example of just how much living standards for masses of people have grown very slowly in recent decades. And in many cases, federal workers have done better than a lot of private sector workers because the government hasn't cut their pay the same way a lot of companies have. And so it's both a reminder of it, and it's not even the most extreme example of it.
Some people are calling for a TSA workers strike if they're not getting paid, and so many are starting to call out sick so they can start to work part-time at other jobs, and it's starting to affect the airports. Why not just go on strike, TSA workers, and put pressure on everybody? I've seen calls for a general strike to get the larger workforce behind the workforce that's being disadvantaged. You know, I don't know, to your original point earlier in the segment, that enough Americans are being put out enough by this one quarter of the federal government being shut down that it feels personal enough or visceral enough for many people, and that even the resistance feels that it has bigger fish to fry right now. But what about these calls for the labor sector itself to get involved behind these workers who are suffering?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could really affect the politics of this. I think the key here is affecting the air traffic system, right? If you could essentially make it so that lots of flights had to be canceled or there were huge delays at airports, Americans would feel that in a very direct way. I think asking federal workers to go on strike is really hard because a permanent strike would really put many of them at risk for being fired. Before we got to that, I really think you'd need to see kind of a mass amounts of support of something that looked like a general strike. I'm in favor of something that looks like either a one-day strike or a large sick out, and essentially show people really what it would be like if all these people who are having to work without being paid didn't go to work, or even 50% of them, and then go from there. But the basic point here is that part of the reason the shutdown is happening is because we don't have a stronger labor movement in this country.
We're almost out of time. Your piece on Sunday, January 5th, headline, "The People versus Donald J. Trump. He is demonstrably unfit for office. What are we waiting for?" Make your case.
Yeah. So my case is he's violated his oath of office and broken the law. That article goes through four different categories, corruption, obstruction of justice, undermining democracy. People can read the full list. So I don't think there's any question that he deserves to be impeached when you look at the standards that the founders set, that we should not simply say, oh, let's leave him there for two more years and hope nothing bad like a war or any other kind of terrible situation that he needs to manage or he creates himself would happen. I think he should be removed. I am not in favor of starting impeachment proceedings immediately because I actually think that would be a favor to him politically. I think the better thing for Democrats in Congress to do, and Republicans who are horrified about this, is to call attention to the things that he has done and wait for the Mueller report. And only then, if it's possible to pry loose some of his Republican support, which I think is more plausible than many people think it is, just because his approval rate has not dropped below 40% doesn't mean it never will. We saw that with Nixon. Mm-hmm. So that's my case. If people kind of want to read three cases, they can read my piece. They can read Michael Tomasky's op-ed in the Times arguing, no, the right thing to do is to wait until 2020 and beat him. And then they can read Yoni Applebaum's cover story in the Atlantic that says, impeach him now. And all three of us come down in different places, although we agree that Trump is unfit for office.
Yeah, that's a good trio of articles. So actually, I think I slightly mischaracterized you as being closer to Yoni Applebaum in the Atlantic than you really are. You are saying wait for the Mueller report, aren't you?
I am saying, to me, it's a question of impeaching him now is a favor to him. It focuses focuses attention on House Democrats who are never going to be popular with Republicans, and basically gives the Republican Party reasons for unity. And instead, I think the Democrats should be strategic about this and try to peel off some of his Republican support. And if you ask yourself, how do they peel off Republican support, which is the only way to get rid of him, I don't think impeachment is part of doing so. I think it's something that would the Democrats who don't like Trump would love, but wouldn't actually persuade anyone. And I would just remind people, Richard Nixon was effectively removed from office. Richard Nixon was never impeached. And so impeaching is not a prerequisite to removing an unfit president from office.
Do you have any take on the BuzzFeed report about Trump directing Michael Cohen to lie to Congress, which even a lot of Republicans think would be an impeachable offense if true? But the report, of course, has been called into question by Robert Mueller's office itself, pushing back on it. Do you have any take on that?
I'm pretty skeptical of it at this point, and I'm skeptical. When I first read it, I thought, and I wrote the next morning in this daily email newsletter that I write that I appreciate your citing, I said, look, this looks plausible to me, but I would encourage people to wait, and one of two things will happen. Other publications will match this story, and then it's almost certainly true, or no one else will match it, and then you should be skeptical. And no one else has matched it. And not only that, but Mueller's office isn't in the business of usually giving statements. And so the fact that they came out and gave a statement, I wouldn't simply parse the statement and try to figure out, well, could BuzzFeed still be true or what parts of it? I would remember that it's really unusual for Mueller's office to make a statement. So they evidently think in some meaningful way that story is wrong. We will eventually find out. It is possible it's more true than false. But at this point, based on the fact that no one else has reported it and Mueller has come out against it, my working assumption is to be quite skeptical of that story.
The peripatetic, I think I'm using that word right, David Leonhardt, New York Times columnist, writer of a daily newsletter and participant in the Times podcast, The Argument, with his fellow columnists Ross Douthat and Michelle Goldberg. Thank you so much for coming on with us, David.
As always, Brian, thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson next.